Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Yoga has been promoted as a healer for many ills, from depression to diabetes. New research has found that yoga also rivals physical therapy for treating low back pain. Joining us by phone is co-author of the study, physical therapy professor and dean of the School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences at the University of Pittsburgh, Anthony DeLitto. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Why did you decide to ask this question?
We were funded from the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, and part of their charge is to look at complementary approaches to pain, and they wanted to do a comparative effectiveness study with yoga and physical therapy.
Were you surprised at the outcome?
Not really. I'm actually tickled pink by the outcome. I'm a physical therapist. I designed the physical therapy program that it was compared to, but I also treat a lot of patients with low back pain. And over the years, I've had patients who choose to do yoga in a more long-term commitment usually report back very favorable results.
Is it yoga per se, or is it the core strength that we're talking about? So are there other ways to get to what you studied without using the word yoga?
I'm not sure. We did do core strengthening and physical therapy, and I hear from yoga instructors that there's a core strengthening component to yoga, but there's also a mind-body component to yoga, and I think you can underestimate that. Obviously, it's very difficult to tease out those differences, but I think most of the people from the yoga world will tell you it's more than just the core strengthening. It's the mind-body relaxation that's very important, too.
So how did you conduct the study? How did you tease out the differences?
Well, we did a trial. We just did a head-to-head comparison between physical therapy, a 12-week program of physical therapy, a 12-week program of yoga. And then we had a third group that we just gave information to. It was a non-movement group. It was almost like our control group. We gave them and then we followed them for 12 weeks. And then after that, we also had a 40-week maintenance phase that, we just tried to enhance what was happening in physical therapy and yoga over this 40-week phase. And then we compared our results at the end of the 40-week maintenance phase.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about yoga as therapy for low back pain. My guest, Tony DeLitto, he is a co-author of a study that found that yoga rivals physical therapy for treating low back pain. He's a physical therapy professor and dean of the School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences at the University of Pittsburgh. If you have low back pain and have questions about how to treat it, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to hear from a yoga instructor who subscribes to this notion that yoga helps with low back pain. So she'll be helping us out as well. You specialize, Tony DeLitto, in physical therapy. How does yoga compare to physical therapy for treating back pain? I mean, what would be the differences between a physical therapy approach and a yoga approach?
Well, physical therapy approach is more of a medically based approach. It's usually included in a person's insurance plan. People come to more of a medical-based environment. Physical therapists spend one-on-one time with patients, and they teach them the basics of the exercise programs, largely with the goal of getting the patients to go home and do the exercises on their own eventually. So, and that's exactly what we did in the study. Yoga is more of first of all, it has the mind-body component, and the exercises are taught. There are different exercises that are taught, the yoga poses and so forth. They are different than what we would do in physical therapy. It's a community-based program, usually out-of-pocket expense on the part of the patient, and I think it's what most people would. There's a component to yoga that again, the mind-body component that I don't think we do at all in physical therapy, or we don't do very much in physical therapy.
The study came out with a set of guidelines. What do those guidelines say?
Basically, I think it's, we can tell our patients pretty confidently that they can make a choice. It's really one of those times where we can say to a patient, if you'd rather go to yoga than physical therapy, then by all means, the likelihood is you're going to get a similar result. They're both going to help. more importantly, both arms of the study, whether they were in physical therapy or yoga, we saw a reduction in pain medication use, and that was a very substantial finding given what we're dealing right now with opioid crises.
What are the leading causes for back pain? What's causing it?
Well, we really don't know the answer to that question. It's a very complex question. I hate to do a runaround on you, but for the most part, most of the people that come in with back trouble, we can't really pinpoint what the causal agent is and what's going on with them. It's kind of like headaches. We don't know what causes headaches a lot, but we know what to do about them and we know how to treat them. And in general, with back pain, what we try to do is get a patient focused on increasing their activity level, the core strengthening components, some stretching, trying to look at how they go about their everyday life with regard to stress, and also with regard to their workplace, and doing some workplace adjustments if their problem is exacerbated by work, or try to find out what kinds of things are bothering them and see if we can adjust the way they do things. That's in general what we do. We treat it mostly symptomatically. But really encouraging patients to stay active and not to disengage from life just because their back is hurting them. That's probably one of the more important things we try to do.
And at what point should someone turn to a physician about low back pain?
When the pain is sufficient to cause them not to disengage from life, to stop doing things they want to do. That's the key component. Because most of the time when people feel pain, they associate pain with harm. They then stop doing things that are activity-based, and that has a very negative effect. First of all, it many times doesn't help the back pain. And secondly, it over the long term, patients become deconditioned. And when they become deconditioned, they actually exacerbate the condition. So we really want to get patients in to seek help and try to get them reactivated with life, to learn how to, many times we can help with the pain and then also get them reengaged with life.
Anthony DeLito, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
It's my pleasure.
Anthony DeLito is a physical therapy professor and dean of the School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences at the University of Pittsburgh. He also is co-author of a study that has found that yoga rivals physical therapy when it comes to low back pain. So thanks again for that. Joining us now is the founder and director of Be Yoga and Wellness in Upper Arlington, Jennifer Barilak. Jennifer teaches a class on yoga for back health. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here.
What inspired you to start a class dedicated to the back?
Well, I've been teaching for 16 years, and over those years had a lot of students come in and be helped by yoga. And although yoga can be really great for the back, there are some poses that can be contraindicated that could potentially make it worse depending on what's going on. So the thought of having a class specific to people with back injuries seemed real appealing.
Your back health classes are taught by a physical therapist and a yoga instructor. How do you work together to teach that class?
Actually, the physical therapist is no longer at the studio. But really what we do is we just bring a lot of evidence-based information into the class. You know, we look to science to guide us. We also look to learn from our students, to know from them what poses they can be in without pain, and to modify when we need to.
So when you do a class about that deals with back issues, what do you want to know about your students beforehand?
Yeah, we ask them to fill out some information to tell us, you know, if they've had surgeries, you know, if they've had any type of diagnosis. Some people come in with that information and other people just have generalized back pain. And then we talk to them about, you know, what feels good, what doesn't feel good. You know, the class is really geared toward keeping the body safe. And just as Dr. DeLito mentioned in the study, they chose poses that can be very balancing for the back. Poses that help to stretch the back, help to strengthen it. And in doing so, we decompress the spine, we bring more circulation to the spinal discs, and we help to support the natural curvature of the spine.
Are you ever concerned that somebody's in the class who shouldn't be and you ask them to go make sure that they get a physician, somebody to look at it to make sure it's not something that you – how would you know if they don't have a diagnosis?
Yeah, you know from observing them. There's a lot you can tell from the body when you're paying attention to it. So you'll see expressions on the face that maybe a pose isn't comfortable. And in our classes, they're small enough that the teacher is observing the students. You know, I'm walking around the classroom noticing the alignment of the student. We're using different props to support the body. So we might be using blocks or a strap to help reach so that we're not straining. And if ever it seems like that the student really needs to be consulting with a doctor, then we're certainly recommending that. A lot of our students have already worked with a doctor or a physical therapist, but they have lingering pain. And so that's where we're trying to help them.
Let's talk about some of the poses that focus on the back.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me what some of the more popular ones are, the ones you kind of your go-to poses?
Yeah, well, you know, the study mentions this pose, and we call it knees to chest, and it's a really simple pose, and pretty much everybody can do it. You do need to get down on the floor, but I also tell people who wake up in the morning with back pain to just do it in your bed before you get in.
So you're laying on your back?
You're laying on your back, and you're drawing your knees in towards your chest as much as you can, bringing a hand to each knee, and that position is very relaxing for the back. You know, I would say most people that have back issues are comforted by that pose. And then you can bring a little bit of movement into that position by rocking side to side a little bit or circling your knees. And then next thing you know, you're starting to relax your back muscles a little bit more and easing some of the tension there.
And some others, yeah.
Yeah, some of the others are then, you know, if you're doing that in your bed or on your floor, get up onto your hands and knees, you know, and the spine is also very relaxed in that position.
Yeah.
Yeah. We call it tabletop or all fours or hands and knees position. And then from that position, you might start walking your hands forward as you draw the pelvis back to start lengthening the spine. Another pose that's very safe, no matter what back condition we have, it helps to start lengthening the spine. So over time, we've shortened the space between each vertebra. We've started to compress some of our spinal discs. And that's a gross generalization. It's not true for everybody. But generally, gravity has that effect on our spine. And so what we're looking to do is really to bring some length into the spine. And that simple pose on your hands and knees, stretching your fingers forward and stretching your pelvis.
The child's
back,
pose.
You know, a little bit more than child. Okay. I call it half downward dog.
Okay.
But it's still gentle enough that almost anybody can do it. And if ever we have knee pain, we can put a blanket underneath us. We can also do this pose sitting in a chair, and I call it kitchen table yoga.
Hmm. You know, just so you're sitting?
Just to sit at your kitchen table in a hard back chair, you know, and then to pull the chair away from the table a little bit to then lay your forearms and your forehead down on the corner of the table, and then you're in a very similar position that brings length to the spine. You could go a little bit further by relaxing your arms down to your thighs and doing it that way. So there's a lot we can actually do in our kitchen to help our spine while we're waiting for a pot of water to boil.
Anthony DeLito talked about the mind-body connection, too. So even if you're doing it, even if I'm doing it, all of that by myself, nothing compares to having a yoga instructor.
It's true.
Giving me permission to thank myself and to thank my body for being strong today and all this kind of stuff.
Well, and we laugh at it, but
no,
it is,
I'm not laughing.
It is
mean,
an important
it's
aspect.
A real deal.
And, you know, that's one thing I've really tried to do at Be Yoga and Wellness is to create an environment where students can walk in the door and instantly feel relaxed, that they're giving themselves permission to leave behind their stress, their worries, you know, whatever is on their plate. And so part of it is you're setting that stage for relaxation. You know, we always start our classes with the brief centering, focusing on the breath, doing some relaxation. As he mentioned, the importance of the breath really comes into play because when we can breathe deeply and slowly, we actually have a very positive effect on our parasympathetic nervous system. And then our body really starts to relax. So some of those deeper layers of tension can start to melt away a little bit. It's not necessarily going to happen all in one class. It can be, you know, a process. But as we learn to breathe deeply and to be conscious of relaxing the body, some special things can really happen combined with the physical poses.
Another thing in a yoga class, at least my experience has been that the instructor is constantly telling people what alternatives they can do. And if you don't feel like doing this today, that's okay. Go into a child's pose or whatever it might be. There's always
this choice.
Yes,
you should be seeking out a yoga class where the instructors are giving you those options. So if we have a shoulder injury, there might be a pose that's beneficial to most of the class, but not for you because you have a shoulder injury. Now, just because you have that injury doesn't mean you shouldn't be doing yoga and getting the benefits from it. So modifications for those types of things are really important.
And finally, are there poses that you think are unsafe for people with back pain? I mean, are there things that you avoid in those back classes that you would do in a typical?
You know, the one pose that really comes to mind is the forward bending. So those poses can be challenging.
Where you kind of bend down like a hinge, keep your back flat going down. Okay.
Yeah. Now it's important to keep the back flat, but a lot of people are unable to do that.
Right.
So sometimes we have tightness in our hamstrings and our hip flexors that prevent us from coming into a forward bend safely. And because of that, it can put pressure on the spine and on some of those spinal discs that can exacerbate a back injury. Now, that's not true with everybody, but it just really depends. And so those are, generally speaking, one of the categories of poses that we're shying away from, especially if it is a seated forward bend. And that's where laying on the back with knees drawn to chest is a nice way to get some of those effects of the pose without doing a forward bend.
Without the stresses of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Jennifer Bareluck, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me in. It was a pleasure.
Jennifer Bareluck is a teacher and director at Be Yoga and Wellness in Upper Arlington. We'll have a link to the study that showed the comparisons between yoga and physical therapy in treating lower back pain on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. One-third of the world's population is obese or overweight. The typical response is to eat less and move more. But in a world of highly processed, sugary, and fatty foods, less isn't that simple to achieve. Food addictions, overeating, and binge eating are real challenges. Columbus Health and Wellness Coach Dr. Paige O'Mahony writes about how to treat overweight patients. She's the co-author of a new book entitled Helping Patients Outsmart Overeating, Psychological Strategies for Doctors and Healthcare Providers. She joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So the book is for doctors healthcare providers. Could anybody benefit from it, though?
Yes, we intentionally wrote the book to be accessible not only to healthcare professionals, but also to lay people.
You are critical of weight loss plans and special diet programs. Why is that?
Well, it really goes to the issue of sustainability. And by their very nature, diets are a temporary solution to a problem that requires a long-term sustained solution.
What if it's a good diet?
How do you define good diet?
I don't know. I mean, that's the thing, is it's a healthy diet. It's a good idea, but you're saying that even that, if it's stricture, it's often not sustainable?
Well, it really does go to the question of sustainability, and it is an individual decision, and it really depends on the individual as to what is sustainable and long-term really serves their wellness.
And as far as a healthy diet, does that differ between individuals as well?
It can, yes.
In your book, you mentioned dysregulated eating. What do you mean by that?
Yes. So dysregulated eating really refers to eating out of attunement with hunger and satiety signals. So people who engage in dysregulated eating might eat when they're not hungry, or not stop when they're full or satisfied, or not be able to identify when they've had enough. And a lot of people who have weight struggles actually are experiencing eating dysregulation. Not all. You cannot tell by looking at a person whether or not they have a good relationship with food and eating. But for a lot of people who struggle with their weight, those weight problems are actually eating problems. And eating dysregulation is at the heart of that.
So then that requires somebody sit down and understand what they're eating all day long.
Yes, and that's the difference between a diet, which really is an external locus of control or where the rules come from outside the person, and the regulation of eating, which comes from within, which comes from attuning or tuning into appetite signals and recognizing how the person is feeling.
So some people bring snacks to work and they're organized and they're in little packets and they know that they can eat that so much a day, or they may not even do that. They just know that if they only have a couple handfuls of whatever their maybe their nuts and dried fruit thing is, that that's all they need. And but then there's other people who like eat every single packet in one day.
Right.
They try, but it doesn't work for them.
Well, and that's where really an individual approach is required. And part of the exciting thing that we wanted to let people know about in this book is that there are learnable skills. Psychology has a lot to offer people who struggle with their eating. And by learning these skills, people really can create an individualized approach to their eating that works for them and helps them sustain their wellness long term and sustain the behaviors that keep them healthy long term.
Give me an example of something in psychology that most people can relate to that would help.
So, for example, the skill of self-regulation is something that a lot of us, even in medicine, have never given much thought to. But a lot of high achievers especially delay eating all day long. They're always attending to more important things, or they're trying to satisfy the requirements of work and family and other activities. And they might delay their self-care, and they might not plan ahead and pack a snack to have on hand. And then at the end of the day, they're tired and depleted. And so they reach for whatever is available. And so by really stopping and thinking about that and thinking, wow, how can I really fortify myself for the day and regulate my energy expenditure before I actually need it? Well, I could bring a snack. I could take a short break and walk around the office. I could take that walk that I keep depriving myself of because my to-do list is 100 items long. So that simple skill of self-regulation, which really has nothing to do with the content of the diet, has everything to do with patients being, and people in general, being able to be successful in taking good care of themselves.
What drives food addiction? I mean, obviously, it's chemistry at a certain point, right? But why can some people eat sugar whenever they feel like it and other people say they're addicted to sugar?
Well, there's a lot of controversy, as you know, behind food addiction. And some people feel that there are certain compounds in food that are addictive, and some people reject that.
Okay.
So different
You mean
researchers,
experts reject that?
Different experts,
yeah.
Yes, will reject it. And so it really depends on the individual person. I think some people who feel that they can't control what they're eating or that they are addicted to a certain kind of food, again, are not regulating their intake and maybe not formulating a plan that allows them to be consistent throughout the day in tuning in, figuring out how they're feeling, trying to register whether or not this is an appetite signal, I'm hungry, or whether it's an emotional signal, I'm tired or I'm frustrated or I'm anxious. And so being able to, again, tune inward really allows people to figure out how much to eat and when to stop.
It's pretty shocking that a third of the world now is considered overweight or obese. And this is happening in developing countries as well as developed countries. Has a lot to do with what food we have access to. People who are able to avail themselves of someone like you and hire you to help them figure it out probably are from a pretty privileged sector of the economy. What about people who can't afford to hire someone to help them? How do they do it themselves?
That's a great question. And that's true. Our hope in writing this book was to make this information accessible to people who could not afford private therapy or private coaching. And so the hope is that by training a generation of physicians, nurses, dietitians, healthcare providers, and providing them with support for the job that they're already doing with additional tools, that they will then be able to help their patients to access the help that they need.
This week, U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommended that children and teens get screened for obesity starting at 6 years old. Starting at that young of an age, what can people do for their children to get them? I mean, how much of children, I guess, bad eating or dysregulated eating begins in childhood?
Well, a lot of it depends on the environment that the child is raised in. And I do think that there is a great deal of alarm that actually is making things worse for kids in this country. And the reason that I got interested in this subject was that as a pediatrician, when I was seeing young patients and their families, there was a great deal of fear and stigma and shame around this issue. And the fact of the matter is that healthy bodies come in a variety of shapes and sizes. And I don't even use terms like obese and overweight because they are judgmental. And I prefer terms like higher weight that are more descriptive without being judgmental. When it comes to kids, we have to be so careful because bodies grow at different rates. And it is not unusual for children to put on pounds before and during puberty. And if we disrupt their attunement to their internal signals and sound the alarm about their bodies being in excess of a certain size, we set them up for a lifetime of eating dysfunction. And so really, support is what it is needed for children to appreciate their bodies and also to tune into their hunger and satiety signals, learn to recognize their different emotions, and learn how to eat in attunement with those signals. And that requires the family and the physician and the whole community.
You know, we went through a long period where it just increasingly kids going to school were having treats all the time. I remember when I was in grade school, one time a teacher gave us a piece of candy in all of grade school. And now it's just all the time, or it got to that point. Now some schools are banning treats, banning all those birthday things and that kind of a thing. But a lot of places still have them. How do you deal with that when it comes to kids and helping them regulate their eating?
That's true. Those highly processed, very high sugar, high fat foods are readily available and they're inexpensive and they are very easy to access. And so that's where the conversation within the family and talking with kids about healthy eating and how a given food feels in their bodies and really encouraging them to start early thinking about what foods serve them and what good foods give them energy and make them feel great will help them, even if they don't make perfect choices all the time. Perfection is not required. What we're trying to do is really empower them to tune into their own signals and to start seeking out those healthier options. Kids can be taught to prepare foods ahead of time with the close supervision of a parent and to think about what kinds of foods they might want to have with them in a given situation and what kinds of foods they might want to choose at school to achieve that balance in terms of sustaining their energy during the day.
You know, that height and weight index that a lot of us go by.
BMI, yes.
Yeah. It you say that it's not a complete indicator of health or fitness. So what does signify health and fitness to you? How do you know that somebody's doing it right?
That's a great question. The issue with BMI, of course, is that it doesn't address body composition. So it's just weight for height. And it assumes that being in excess of a particular number is automatically unhealthy, which is far from true. Bodies come in all shapes and sizes. And so really, when it comes to wellness, it's about tuning into the internal signals and about acquiring the skills to eat in your best interest most of the time and to eat what we call normally most of the time, which is choosing foods that satisfy and eating in attunement with those internal signals.
We all have foods we like to indulge in. Some of us have many foods. How do you advise people to still enjoy those and recognize them? I was listening to something on NPR yesterday about cherries and how they're so low in calories. And, you know, we really can indulge in them all you want if you can afford them. That is, you know, the cherries you get in the produce section, not the maraschino cherries for you out there with your cocktails. But how do you know?
Well, there's with the diet mentality, of course, there's all sorts of guilt and shame around choosing foods that you enjoy. But the fact of the matter is that eating normally and eating in a way that promotes your health and wellness for life involves enjoying certain foods and really eating foods that are nourishing and healthful most of the time, and also indulging in foods that you enjoy when you feel like you have a craving for them. What is most important, really, is tuning in and stopping at enough, enjoying it while you're eating it, staying mindful and connected to appetite, and trying to achieve that balance rather than the reactive, oh no, I've broken my diet, now I should just eat the whole thing mentality of diets. So, and that's what we strive to teach, is those skills that enable people to stay regulated and to be able to enjoy all different kinds of foods.
If somebody is really struggling, if someone has struggled, you know, they want to lose weight, do you recommend not only a dietitian or a nutritionist, but also a psychologist, a counselor?
Yes, that's the beautiful thing about our medical system today, is that there is now this opportunity to take an interdisciplinary collaborative approach. So there are eating disorders therapists and dietitians who are trained in intuitive eating, and all kinds of other health professionals, health and wellness coaches who can help. And really what we recommend is that patients talk to their doctors and explain the issues that they're having and understand that their weight problem may well actually be an eating problem.
And you want to be if you want to lose weight, you'd go to a psychologist, some kind of counselor. You want them to be on the same page with you.
Right. And typically if the focus is exclusively on weight loss, it tends not to work as well as having a focus on health. And taking a more weight inclusive approach, which means focusing on health rather than focusing on a particular number on the scale, has been shown to really promote long term success.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Paige O'Mahony, for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Dr. Paige O'Mahony is a health and wellness coach and co-author of a new book. It's entitled Helping Patients Outsmart Overeating, Psychological Strategies for Doctors and Healthcare Providers. More Wellness Wednesday is coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Classroom work is typically associated with what ends up on the report card. A new study has found that after-school exercise could be important, too. New York Times Well blog columnist Gretchen Reynolds recently wrote about that in other fitness news, and she joins us by phone. Welcome back, Gretchen.
Thanks very much for having me.
In general, I mean, how much exercise are kids supposed to be getting?
A lot more than most are getting, unfortunately. The standard federal guidelines, and these are based on a lot of research, suggest that anyone under the age of 18 should be getting an hour of moderate to vigorous exercise every day. That means running around. That means, you know, playing tag, playing games, just being up and really moving. And that should be for at least 60 minutes. And the best estimates right now are that 2 out of 3 kids are not getting close to that much exercise.
And this isn't just about weight, right? Now we're talking about cognitive abilities.
What a number of studies have found, and then I'll talk about the one in particular that I wrote about, mm-hmm. but that one of the things that tends to happen when kids are not moving much is that they start to put on fat around their abdomen, just like adults do. And that's really unhealthy. It's called visceral fat. And it's the fat that's deep inside your belly. and that wraps around organs, and that also in adults has been associated with a decline in cognitive function. And it used to be that no one thought that was happening in kids, because they barely even thought that kids could put on visceral fat. Well, inactive kids put on visceral fat starting at the age of 4 or 5. And the more of it they have, the more of it looks like it can affect their ability to think. And so the study that I wrote about recently involved a big program that they were doing at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. And they actually got a really large group of kids to start an after-school exercise program. It wasn't called exercise. It was called fun.
Heavens no. Right.
Exactly. And it should be fun. I mean, kids should, they should want to move. And this was a program where the neighborhood kids, a really large group of kids from all of the nearby elementary schools, these were 8 to 10-year-old kids, came in every day after school to the university, and they played for an hour. They were supervised so that they really were moving, but they were playing tag. They were playing with balls. They were just running around. They weren't doing a lot of sit-ups and push-ups and things. They were just having fun. And they were, as I said, supervised so that the scientists did know that their heart rates were rising. They really were moving. And they would do that for about an hour. And before the kids started, they did body composition tests to see what kind of body fat they had. Quite a few of the kids were, by the age of 8, obese. Quite a few of them already had a significant amount of visceral fat. So half of the kids were doing the exercise program, and half were told they would get to start a year later. So those were the control group. And then they also had the kids do some tests basically of their ability to think, how well they could pay attention, how well they could make decisions, how well they could think. And then the scientists, after a year of the kids either playing every day or not, they retested them. And the really discouraging part, and again, these are 8 to 10-year-old kids, is the kids who were not part of the playgroup, who just went on with their normal lives, they had put on a significant amount of visceral fat. And if they had been overweight a year before, they now had 4 times as much visceral fat. these are really young children.
But it points out that it's a very key time for weight gain.
It is, and that kids at this age can really pack on a really amazing amount of visceral fat, which is, for every kind of reason, the worst kind of fat. That's true in adults, and it's true in children.
As far as the visceral fat issue goes, is this a correlation that they've made between visceral fat and cognitive decline, or is it a causation, and do they know why?
Well, they have found causation in animals. that if they find a way to increase visceral fat in animals, there is a very clear change in how their brains work and the number of neurons that they make, the connections between neurons, all sorts of things. So that has been seen in animals. We clearly can't do those studies in people, but there is a really strong correlation, particularly in adults, between the amount of visceral fat and how well they think. That there's a pretty significant decline in the ability to think clearly if adults put on more visceral fat. And in this case, what they found was the kids who were part of the play group, almost all of them lost visceral fat as a percentage of their total body weight. Again, these are kids who were growing, so you don't want them losing weight. But even if the kids stayed overweight, and some of them were obese, if they were moving around, they were losing visceral fat, and they performed much better on these tests of their cognitive skills, of their ability to think.
So these school districts and these conversations that they're having at the state level about how kids are testing in school, they're talking about cutting back on recess so kids spend more time in the classroom. And you're saying that at this point, that's counterproductive.
This is part of a really large and growing body of research that shows very, very strong links between kids moving and kids thinking better. And some of these studies are very straightforward. If kids get up and walk around for half an hour and then take a math test, they generally do better. So the effects can be acute, meaning almost immediately, if kids are not sitting down, they tend to do better academically. But they're also very chronic in terms of the more kids move, the better they tend to do on all tests of attention and also of just straightforward things like math and reading. It's a terrible idea to cut recess.
And having a kid go to a tutoring session right after school where they're sitting down with the tutor for an hour, bad idea.
The science would seem to suggest they will actually get more academic success out of spending that hour running around playing tag
and
sitting down doing math.
And again, another key word here is playing. If they're going and playing in the play-like sense, not playing baseball or hockey or basketball practice, we're talking about kids just running around.
Exactly. And one of the reasons that that is important is because there is also a growing body of evidence that kids need to have motor skills. And that motor part of the brain connects to the parts of the brain that also are involved in academic skills and thinking rationally and logically. And so a lot of kids nowadays have much worse what they call motor skills than they did a generation ago. And that isn't just going to affect their ability to get a college scholarship playing sports. It does seem to change the actual structure of the brain. And that does seem to linger for throughout adulthood. So we need to get our kids moving, get their bodies working, get them familiar with how their body works. And you do that by letting kids run around and play. Let them play tag. Let them throw a ball, but they don't have to play, you know, a formal form of soccer. They can just run and play and feel how their body moves.
I don't think I've ever heard you sound so passionate about anything, Gretchen Reynolds.
I do feel passionately about this because the implications for 10, 20, 30 years from now are just huge. I really do believe, and this is an opinion, I do believe we are doing our children a disservice by not having them be out and playing. And it also feeds into what children want. Their bodies want to be in motion, and we are undercutting that.
Let's switch gears here a second. This is awkward, but let's turn to bath time.
Sure.
This is not a good segue. Hot baths before workouts. We know that lots of athletes use a cold bath after a workout, but you say a hot bath before a workout could be beneficial. Why is that?
In this case, this is actually not that much of a segue because it's also important that kids be safe if they're running around outside in this kind of heat.
So pop them in the bath first. Okay, yeah.
I know it's hot there in Ohio. I live in New Mexico, and
it's hot.
Yes. And it becomes that our bodies are not adapted to working out in the heat if we've just gone through a long winter. And so what we need to do when the weather suddenly gets warm like this is we need to acclimate ourselves to exercising in the heat if we are going to keep working out outside, if we are actually just even going to be active outside. And there are a couple of ways you can do that. One is you can try and just sort of cool your skin by wrapping icy towels on your neck, and you can drink a slushy. You can do things like that. But those are very short-term ways to deal with the heat. The science shows pretty clearly that it's much more effective to acclimate your body slowly. But that can be difficult for some of us because it's really hard to be out in the heat if you're not acclimated. So a study that I wrote about, they were looking at how best to prepare athletes, and these were pretty serious athletes, mm-hmm. for competing in the heat. And one of the things that they found is that acclimating over about 5 days is better than wearing ice vests or things like that. And that one way you can acclimate that is really easy is to go for a short or an easy run for about 30 minutes or walk, if that's what you're doing, in the heat, and then come back and get in a hot bathtub, which allows your body to acclimate to the heat without you being out in the heat.
Well, what's the point of getting in a hot bathtub after you've done a warm-up run?
Because it keeps your internal heat high,
okay.
for another 30 minutes, so your body is doing, as far as your body knows, you're outside running. If you're lying there in these hot conditions, the body still has to get rid of the body heat that you're generating. So you're teaching your body how to deal with heat. And in this case, what the hot bath does is keep your internal temperature up for another 30 minutes. So basically, you're allowing your body to acclimate to high temperatures without having to be out in the high temperatures. So it's a little safer. It's a little easier. It still requires at least 5 or 6 days before you're going to be ready to run for an hour in the heat.
Is this something that only applies when we're talking about hot weather climates? Is there a reversal when we're talking about cold weather?
It's actually much easier to acclimate to cold weather because you don't build up. But the problem with exercising in hot weather is that you do build up heat internally, your core temperature. Mm-hmm. And if the core temperature rises high enough, that's when you have heat illnesses. And that means everything from just not feeling nauseous to heat stroke, which obviously is life-threatening. You have to prepare your body for those conditions. You have to make it able to recognize and get rid of the heat that's building up. And it does look like one easy way to acclimate is to go for a short workout and then lie in a hot tub. So you're not outside long enough, hopefully, to put yourself at risk or to get really uncomfortable, but you are preparing yourself for longer exercise in the heat. You can also go to a gym and stay in the air-conditioned conditions if you prefer.
But that's not a good way to train if you're going to be doing an obstacle course or a run or a marathon or anything like that competitively.
No, exactly.
You need to be doing it.
If you are going to be competing outside, you have to prepare outside. And that's what this study showed, is that it's helpful. It's important to acclimate. You can also, in the very short term, put ice on your head, put ice on your neck, wear frozen shorts, and all those things will help somewhat. But you really do need to acclimate over time.
And if you're on your way to a run, say, you know, I mean, an obstacle course, when I know I did one several years ago where by 8 o'clock in the morning, it was almost 90 degrees. And it was like about a half hour, maybe 40 minute drive to get there. And I said, let's just leave the windows down because it's only going to get worse when we stop. In other words, not turn the air conditioning on in the car.
That actually is probably a very good idea. Any ways in which you can sort of put yourself in hot weather, hot conditions without it being dangerously hot, without mm-hmm. it being that, you know, 125 degrees in Phoenix yesterday.
Yeah. 119, you exaggerate slightly, but I'll let you do that. Well, Gretchen Reynolds, thank you so much for joining us as usual. Always appreciate your insights. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Gretchen Reynolds is a columnist for the New York Times Wellness blog. Thanks for listening. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.